मा ओम विष्णु पदाय कृष्ण प्रस्ताय भूतले श्रीमती भक्ति वेदांत स्वामिनीति नामने नमस्ते सरस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणी विशेष शून्यवारी पश्चात सुधारिणी ओम ज्ञान धीमरं दश्य गंजन शलकया चक्षुर मृतम जैनम तस्माय श्री गुरवे नमः वंश कल्पतृभ्यश्च कृप सिंधुभ्येभ्य तीतनां भावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः. So this evening, I thought we'd talk a little bit about what the Bhagavad Gita says about transmigration of the soul, also known as reincarnation. The first thing we need to understand before we get into it is a little... We're going to start from the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and in this chapter, Krishna tells Arjuna, first of all, entry-level spiritual knowledge. And all spiritualists from the tradition of the Vedas, whatever different school they belong to, this everyone accepts. And what they accept is that I am a spiritual being. As it says in the Upanishads, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. Now, I used to take courses in Hinduism in the university, and I always knew this Aham Brahmasmi, but I didn't really find out what it practically meant until I met Krishna devotees. Because Prabhupada actually spelled it out, the corollary. Aham Brahmasmi means I am spirit. So what it implies also is I'm not matter, which is to say, I'm not this body. There's why some English professor wrote a book about the Hare Krishna movement called I Am Not This Body. She was so struck by that that phrase. And actually, it's good news, at least to those of us over 50. So one has to understand the difference between the actual who I actually am. Because the idea of spiritual knowledge in the Vedas is we are all now in a state of ignorance, or maya. And this means we do not know who we are. And this lack of knowledge of who we are is actually the cause of suffering. We do not know who we are. And that's why it is said that one needs to engage in the process of self-realization. We have to do something to understand who we actually are. And so here Krishna is talking about the soul, or the Atma, and the body. These terms are, like soul is very confusing to people from the West, because many times we've heard the idea of the soul, but we think, if we believe in it, that I am a body and I have a soul. But actually, the opposite is the case. I am a soul and I have a body, temporarily. Because the Sanskrit word that I'm translating as soul is actually Atma. That means self. So I am the soul, and the soul right now, I am now, it's situated in this body. It's much in the same way as when I wanted to go for a drive, I get in a car and drive the car. In fact, the body is sometimes called a yantra. That means a machine or vehicle. So I'm situated in this body, and this is my vehicle. Now, when we say soul, atma, people don't have any idea what you're talking about. It's some vague notion of something you can't experience. It's like the word God. We have no idea what they refer to or what they mean. It's some word from the past, maybe. It's not really relevant. So what does it mean to say the soul? When I was studying philosophy in a university, our professors told us that that the idea of the soul was meaningless. The sense "I have a soul" was not just wrong, it was meaningless, because they say no experience, no sense experience you could have is possibly relevant to establishing whether it's true or false. And so it's a cognitively meaningless phrase. Same with God and things like that. But it is not true that we cannot experience the soul. And in fact, according to the Vedas, it's the soul which gives us the ability to have any experiences at all. Because the symptom of the soul is consciousness. And this consciousness that is here, that allows me to undergo experiences, to be a subject, not just an object, to have significance for myself, this consciousness, according to the Vedas, is due to the presence of the soul. Otherwise, a material thing, this microphone, it's a machine made of matter, like my body is a machine made of matter. There's nobody at home. It's not conscious, doesn't undergo experiences, just entirely an object. But this machine that I'm in right now, somebody's at home and undergoing experiences. But and this conscious entity, the soul, is actually the self. But now I am this self, which is an eternal spiritual spark of the Supreme Self, is now situated in this temporary machine. This body goes through its various changes, and the soul is there. But the soul itself, as spiritual, has the qualities of spirit. The qualities of spirit are three: Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of ananda, bliss or joy. This is the nature of the soul, its own intrinsic nature. And that's what I am, but I do not experience myself that way. I was born at a certain time and I will die at a certain time, and the whole thing will be enclosed in a pair of parentheses, and that's my life, huh? Beginning and end. Neither am I full of knowledge. There's so many things I don't know, and what I do know I'm usually wrong about anyway. We're groping around in the dark trying to figure out our way through this world. Very little information about what's actually happening. We are not full of knowledge. And we're subjected to all kinds of miseries. And usually what we call happiness is just the temporary absence of some suffering. It's not really positive bliss. So how can I say I'm Satchit Ananda? Well, because the reason we don't experience ourselves that way is because of this false projection of our identity onto the material body. We're in this body, and we just automatically think this is me. And whatever the feature of the body is, I think this is me. That I'm male or female, I'm black or white, I'm smart, I'm stupid, I'm beautiful, I'm ugly, I'm old, I'm young, whatever these things, these all belong to the body, and I think this is me. I've identified myself with the material body. And because of this identification of self with the body, whatever happens to the body I experience is happening to me. And so that's how I end up in this material existence, and I'm subject to so much suffering. What suffering? Well, the real problems of life, according to the Vedas, are birth, old age, disease, and death. These are mentioned because you can solve a lot of problems. People think maybe they'll solve their problems if they get enough money. No matter how much money you have, there's birth, there's old age, there's disease, there's death. No matter what your condition of life, good or bad, these are always going to be there. If you want to be happy, solve the death problem. If you have a lot of money, you may die in a very high-tech way. Congratulations. You can be paying doctors a fortune just to die in this manner. But the death is there. So these are the real problems. Now, the reason we have difficulty in this material world is that we are eternal spiritual beings, and yet the body is temporary. And therefore it is really an incompatible situation for us. Therefore we are always never at ease in this material world. And we are never fully satisfied, because what we seek, because we are eternal, we are also seeking eternal happiness. But because, and we try to satisfy the self, but we think the self is the body, and we try to satisfy the self by satisfying the body, and it does not happen. Maybe we get a little bit of pleasure, it's temporary, and then it goes away. So we always do this, we put ourselves in some situation where we find out some pleasure or happiness, it lasts a while, and it goes away. How do you feel when it goes away? Well, I feel sad, I feel let down, I feel upset. Why do I feel this way? Well, I have to say it's because I wanted it to keep on going. And if you ask me, how long did you want it to keep on going? I'll have to say, well, how long can I have? Can I have forever? So actually, if you look at it a little bit, you see really what we're looking for is happiness that never comes to an end. But we're looking for it in a place where everything is temporary. I hate to tell this to young people in a way, because they don't really believe me. But the material world is not the place to look for happiness. Here's another example. One of the basic urges of every living being is self-preservation. Right? If you study any biology class, the instinct of self-preservation is enormously powerful, and what everything that lives, from the tiniest squiggle to the human being, they want to just stay alive. And when human beings get into extreme positions, that urge to survival comes out, and in those positions they sometimes do quite horrible things just to stay alive. They trample on women and children, they murder and eat their friends, and so much, because that instinct of self-preservation is so strong. So everyone, not just humans, every living thing has the instinct of self-preservation. They just want to be alive. Now, who has succeeded? Every single one. Dead. Did not work. What are our prospects for happiness then, if these things cannot be satisfied here? But there's no problem that we want to be happy. Naturally, that's also there on the spiritual platform. Well, it's not that the search for happiness is wrong, but we are looking in the wrong place. So therefore, the Vedas say we have to, first of all, clear up this confusion. Let you know, you have to know who you really are. that we are the spirit soul. And the spirit soul is in this temporary body. So the soul is the self, and the body is really the not-self. It is in a way, it's my environment. The close-in part of my environment. Usually we put this division between the self and the not-self right here, sort of at the skin, right? This is the boundary. Here I end and here my environment begins. But the Vedas say, no, we have to look at it a different way. And we can do an experiment. If we say the self, the soul, is the seer, as I say, being consciousness, it is that which is conscious. So it's the seer. And then what it sees, what is the seen, that's the not-self. So, of course, normally here we say, okay, I have my senses for perceiving, my ears, my eyes, my tongue, my skin. So, because my senses are in this body is an assembly of senses, I think of here is the seer, and what I see is the not, so this is the environment. But of course, if my eyes are seeing, I am also conscious of my eyes seeing, my ears are hearing, I'm conscious of my ears hearing, my hands and legs are moving, there's another kinds of active instruments, I'm conscious of that. So we have to say that we are also aware of our own body. And so the body is the seeing. So we have to draw the boundary back. This body is also is the not-self. But I'm sitting in the body as in this machine. Well, then the place we normally put the boundary would be between the mind and which is the subtle body and the gross body. And certainly we identify much more closely with our mind. If I lose a part of my gross body, a leg or something, well, okay, but I'm still me. But if I lose a part of my mind, then I feel like my identity's really been affected in a bad way. So we identify ourselves much more closely anyway with the mind, with our thinking and feeling and willing. But we can continue the experiment and think, well, my mind is thinking and I'm conscious of what my mind is thinking. So many feelings and memories are going through my mind. I'm conscious of all of that. So really all our mental or interior operations, I'm also aware of those. So we have to take our mind also and say that is the not-self. And so then what is left is just that which is conscious. We should understand that our mind is our environment. And this is where the environmental movement must begin. We have to clean up the toxic waste. If we leave this part out, it will never work anywhere else. Our mind is where we live. It makes all the difference. So in the Vedic understanding, you could say we have two bodies. One is the gross body, made of solids and liquids and gases, and that's the gross body. And then there's what's called the subtle body, Shukshma Sharira, which I'm conventionally calling here the mind, although the Vedic description is more complicated than that. The mind, this is called the subtle body. And the gross and the subtle body is a single psychophysical unit. We know that, for example, if anger arises in my mind, I get angry, then also my blood pressure goes up, my face turns red. So the subtle affects the gross. And similarly, I take a liquid. Let's say it's a nice little shot of Jack Daniels. Then my mind starts to be affected. Huh? So these two interact together like this. But the self, the soul, is really watching all of this. It is conscious of all of these things. So now, what happens when the body goes? The soul continues, and according to the Vedas, gets another body. So here I'm reading from chapter 2, text 13. In the course of this discussion of explaining the difference between the soul and the body, Krishna says, "Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings." They are on the battlefield, and so kings are there. They used to fight in those days. Whenever was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. Then he says, as the embodied soul continuously passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. The sober person, that is one whose mind is calm, is not bewildered by such a change. So what this is saying is, as far as changing bodies, it's already happening. I'm in this body, but at one time it was quite different. It was a little baby's body. And then gradually it turned and became a young boy's or a girl's body, a child's body, then a young body, then older, then middle age, and finally old age. I'm same person, but what changes of bodies have taken place while I'm sitting right here in it? So I'm already changing bodies. I'm already transmigrating. So Krishna is saying, what's the difficult to understand when this body finally is worn out, used up? You take a new one. So that's why the word transmigration is, in a way, is more accurate, because we're always transmigrating. We're transmigrating through this body and its changes, and then periodically this body goes away, and then we get a new one. Yeah. Again, Krishna, a little later on in the same chapter, he says, this is text number 22, as a person puts on new garments, giving up the old ones, the soul similarly accepts new material bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. It's like changing clothes, one after another, changing costumes. This one gets worn out, doesn't work anymore, and then a change takes place. Now I'm going to skip over. This topic comes up again in the Bhagavad Gita in the 15th chapter, where again in a little more detail this process is described. Krishna has said, starting with text 7, the living entities means the souls, in this conditioned world are my eternal fragmental parts. So we're like little sparks of the divine. Eternal, but fragmental. We're tiny. There's actually a size given. In the Svetashvatara Upanishad, the soul is said to be 1/10,000th, the tip of a hair in size. 1/10,000th, the tip of a hair in size. One of my scientific friends has told me that if that is a human hair they're talking about, that means 1/4 of an angstrom unit. So really quite tiny. So that's a fragment. But it's such a little thing, but still does so much, you know. Brings up bulldozers, moves mountains around, makes them. Anyway, the living entities in this conditioned world are my eternal fragmental parts. Due to conditioned life, they are struggling very hard with the six senses, which include the mind. The mind is sometimes considered another sense. So now he describes this the struggle. The living entity in the material world carries his different conceptions of life from one body to another, as the air carries aroma. Thus, he takes one kind of body again and quits it to take another. So Prabhupada, in this purport, he says, here the living entity is described as Ishwara, the controller of his own body. If he likes, he can change his body to a higher grade. You can get an upgrade. Or a downgrade. And if he likes, he can move to a lower class. Back there near the tail. Minute independence is there. We have some freedom. The change his body undergoes depends on him. At the time of death, the consciousness he has created will carry him onto the next type of body. Krishna's already stated this in the 8th chapter. Whatever conception of life one has at the time of that death, then to that state he will attain. This is the danger of pet ownership. You're in love with your dog. You have danger and you die thinking of your dog. The lady's in bed and she's thinking, Fifi, Fifi, who will walk my Fifi? Somebody will walk her. One has to be a little careful who your friends are and who you love. So Prabhupada says, if he has made his consciousness like that of a cat or a dog, he is surely to change to a cat or dog's body. And if he has fixed his consciousness on godly qualities, he will change into a form of a demigod. And if he is in Krishna consciousness, he will be transferred to Krishna Loka in the spiritual world and will associate with Krishna. So you can end up anywhere on the evolutionary scale, the phylogenetic scale, by this consciousness. Sometimes we say to people, that dog, and it could be quite true, because that's how they act and that's what happens to them. Huh? So anyway, Krishna continues, the living entity thus taking another gross body obtains a certain type of ear, eye, tongue, nose, and sense of touch, which are grouped about the mind. He thus enjoys a particular set of sense objects. So each a different kind of body that we see in this world, animal or even plant, is a particular way of perceiving the world and enjoying sense objects. Prabhupada remarked, for example, say we really get into the sense of taste. I mean, that's what we're really into, is tasting things. There's a better body for that than a human body. It's a fish. A fish body is one big tongue. All along the sides, they have that big long stripe. It's all taste buds. And see, for a tongue to taste, there has to be moisture. Taste depends on water. So when they're in the ocean, therefore they are really into the sense of taste. And of course, we all know that a dog has a very keen sense of smell, and so on. So they all have different ways of perceiving the world. What happens when we transmigrate, at the time of death, we have various kinds of desires to enjoy in a certain way, then we leave off the gross body, but we retain the subtle body. It stays with us. And then that subtle body now is able to acquire a gross body that now fits its current desires. And according to good and bad deeds, we have done good deeds or bad deeds, also we can go up and we can go down. So this is how this takes place. We are carried in the subtle form of the subtle body, maintaining all its material desires. Now, if our desire, if we are pure, if our desire is spiritual, if our desire is to serve the Lord, then we'll not take birth again in this material world. That's really the goal, is to stop the process. It's not really a lovely thing to be transmigrating. It's called mrityu samsara. We are on the path of repeated birth and death in the material world. So although this transmigration goes on, ultimately it's a trap. Because although we keep going, what does that keep going? Birth, and then old age, disease, death, then birth again, old age, disease, death, birth, old age, disease, death. Struggling hard each time, trying to achieve something, going through the whole business over and over again, diapers, school, job, unemployment, struggling for this, trying to then start all over again. It's really terrible. It's like just running on a treadmill. You don't really get anywhere. You may go up, and then you come back down again. You go back up, and you come back down again. You go back up, and you come back down again. So this is the life of bondage. It is said, by the way, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we're talking about the subtle body, which keeps us with its full of material desires. It says that devotional service dissolves the subtle body of the living entity. That is to say, not in a literal way, but as far as it's composed of material desires, those things go away. And then one becomes liberated from this. Krishna finishes this discussion. He says, the foolish cannot understand how a living entity can quit his body, nor can they understand what sort of body he enjoys under the spell of the modes of nature. But one whose eyes are trained in knowledge can see all this. The Sanskrit term is jnana chakshusha. He has eyes of knowledge. You can see. This is not, the idea of transmigration, by the way, is not really, it's a truth about the material world. It's happening around us all the time. And if you know how to look, one can see it. You can see what people's mentalities are like. I once saw it was kind of a horrifying book. It was not meant to be horrifying, but it was a big coffee table, a photography book. And on the left-hand side of the page, on the right-hand side of the page, were dogs, their faces. And on the left-hand side were the faces of the dog owners. Oh. And they had these uncanny resemblances. I don't mean to be, you know, worry about pet ownership. There are much worse things, but this is people's mentality, you can see it, and you can understand that this is a future birth. Everybody knows who I have children, and when they were very, very little, just practically just born, you could already see that they had personalities and character traits. If different temperaments were already there in little children that are just born. That comes from the previous life. And if you really like to have kind of empirical evidence, there's a very interesting researcher named Ian Stevenson, who's at the University of Virginia, a physician, has been doing research on evidence for transmigration. He's a very rigorous person. People try to do hypnotic regression and remember their past lives. He doesn't use that kind of evidence because it's subjected to the doubt that there may be some suggestion. So he sought out children who remember their past lives. There are many, many cases of this. And if you start looking for them, there's an astonishing number of them. Children who remember their past lives, and then you can find out what their memories are, and then you can do research, and you can see if it's true or not. So he's compiled his books. They're modestly titled, such as 49 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation. And he does it very, very carefully. And they're uncanny to read, how these a little boy, a little girl in some village remembers this whole thing, and they go 5 miles away, and they find out the whole details of the story. So if this kind of evidence is good for proving anything, it proves transmigration. He goes further, actually. Stevenson noticed that a number of people in the cases that he was investigating, they had were born with birthmarks or some kind of impairment or deformity. And he became interested in those, and he began to notice that these birthmarks or birth defects were related to the way in which the person died. And he was able to, a lot of time, to find drawings or photographs of autopsies and things like that. And it's really, there's one case, here's a boy who had on this side, a round birthmark, on the opposite side, a larger, uneven birthmark. And then they saw that he had, previous verse, birth, had died of a gunshot wound to the face, entry wound, and exit wound. it's pretty solid. I don't think this idea is really something that is just from only from scripture. It's quite something that happens in the world, and even if you take Buddha, for example, Buddha started out as a follower of the Vedas, where it teaches transmigration, and then for various reasons he decided to reject Vedic authority and not speak about anything, not speak about the soul, not speak about the God, anything that was in the Vedas that was metaphysical. He didn't talk about, but he still accepted transmigration. Well, I think to people at that time, it was perfectly self-evident that this is what's going on. It didn't have anything to do with religious authorities or anything. It was just what happened. So anyway, this is the picture. If you like this kind of stuff, you remember the name Eon Stevenson. And type it in Amazon or a search engine. You can find out these books. And the important thing is, though, to know about this is to understand that as long as we act with a desire to enjoy the results. This is when Krishna's Arjuna asked Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, "What is karma?" And Krishna replies, "Actions which produce future material bodies." And those means activities I perform with the desire to enjoy the results. Prabhupada calls them fruitive activities. And therefore, you see many cases when people want to engage in spiritual life and transcend this world, they try to literally stop acting. There's very serious practitioners of yoga do the asanas and the breathing exercises, so they slow down the metabolism of their body and literally stop eating, living on air alone, sitting like this. You've seen these pictures of Mahavir, the giant saints. They're standing like this, and the vines have grown up around their bodies. The implication, they've been there a long time. They don't move. But this is very difficult for us to do because we are by nature active. Actually, it's not just that we're in a material body that we're active. The body itself is made of matter, and it's moving and acting now because the soul is here, and is the soul that makes the body move and act. It's the spiritual touch. So, and at the time of death, the soul leaves the body. Immediately, the body becomes inactive and inert. So life itself is due to the presence of the soul. So why in the soul, in his own proper position, would it suddenly be inactive? So spiritual life means the soul itself is active. So being active is very natural for us, it's not artificial. But if our actions in the material world that we perform for our own desires, they bind us. Those activities can be pious or they can be impious. They can be according to the regulations of some scripture, or they can be in violation. So, of course, with the pious activities, I'm still trying to be the enjoyer. I'm still trying to enjoy in this world, but I accept the restrictions and regulations of scripture. That means my next birth will be pleasant. I'll have the effects of good karma. Good looking, born in a nice family, get an education, have wealth. These are some of the effects of good karma. And bad karma means the opposite. So there's good karma and there's bad karma, but ultimately it's all bad. Because even our good karma, we're still in the material world, there's still birth, death, old age, and disease, and there's always the chance of doing something bad and going back down again to suffer. We are not in any stable position. So therefore, liberation means no karma. But if I cannot stop acting altogether, what do I do? I'm going to shut the gates here. What I do here is I act for the satisfaction of Krishna. To act, there must be some desire, so my desire should be pure and to see that Krishna is satisfied. And that will bring about freedom from birth and death in the material world. And that's the recommendation of Bhagavad Gita. Jai Sushi Panchatattvaki Jai Jagannathai Bhagavati Jai Sushi. Any questions? Comments?
Yeah? This self-evident fact of transmigration is pretty well known in Asia. And I understand it was also well known to some of the early Christian fathers.
Yeah, they're true.
So why was it rejected or eliminated?
I don't know. There was some council that decided they wouldn't accept it.
You know why?
Huh?
Why?
I'm not quite sure. I don't remember. Huh? You know why?
Seventh Constantinople.
Yeah.
It was around the time when they were forming the Holy Trinity, and it was to reinforce the ascension of the Christos, Jesus Christ, and the fact that if you lived more like Christos, Jesus Christ, you would then ascend. And of course, the only way to state that is then to have a deception of hell, somehow you will be like this. To tell people in Christianity that, okay, if you don't actually live quite like crystals, you'll repeat, and then just repeat and repeat. people won't really want to do it. They'll just say, okay, I'll do it next level. I'll do it next level.
Oh, so the idea was that people would become lazy because of this, huh?
Yes. Yeah. That was my understanding of like school level.
But Origen taught transmigration, Clement of Alexander, some of the church fathers, the ones that were heavily influenced by Neoplatonism, taught this. I would say it was pretty much considered a self-evident thing. I don't think necessarily that because I myself understand the truth of transmigration, that I'm any less eager to lead a godly life. Because the idea that, although, you know, from the Christian point of view, you've got a problem. Because, when you see, you know, like babies that are born crack addicted and things like, from the Christian point of view, it's very hard to explain how people are born with such unfortunate conditions like this. If you understand that this is a result of past activities, then at least it's understandable, even from the spiritual point of view, that this may happen.
So they've written the whole problem of evil is a problem that they've created,
right? Most part of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of my professors, a Catholic priest, when I was talking about transmigration, says, yeah, that solves the problem. But I don't think we have it to solve the problem of evil, but it does, because it does create a whole big problem. Why these things happen, it's inexplicable, and you just have to accept it. Yeah?
On 60 Minutes, 2 weeks ago, we did a segment on a boy that was born into a family that had absolutely no musical background whatsoever, no musical instruments whatsoever. And this boy, when he was 2 years old, drew a cello. And then at the age of three, he began composing music. And he's just been, it's just obvious, like, past life, remembrance. That, I mean, he has whole symphonies. 5 years old, he only wrote five symphonies.
Yeah, Mozart was like that too, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but this is about 60 Minutes. And, you know, I mean, they didn't even have a piano in the house. They didn't,
sure.
And he was like writing the score, you know, putting notes down.
Do they bring the transmigration up in 60 Minutes, or they just look at this wild thing that happened and marvel at it?
Yeah, it's marvelous. Yeah. But there's no way that could pick up anything. Right. Except for the beauty side. To me, it was like proof.
One last question. We're running late now. People are probably getting hungry, huh? Yes?
I don't understand the idea of the teaching that the soul has to have a body somewhere, constantly. That the soul, even when it transmigrates into the heavenly planets, and even
Krishna Loka,
all the way up, it still has to have a body.
Well, it doesn't have a body anymore, but the soul is a spiritual person, and person means that the soul has senses. So it's manifest as what you would call a spiritual body, not a material body. Because as an individual, and interacts with other individuals and an environment and social. So therefore that individuality is there. We describe that as a spiritual body.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The teaching is that the soul can't do these things without a body.
Well, by definition, to do them means to have a body. You cannot do anything without a body, without instruments of action and instruments of reception. If you don't want to do anything, then there's another place to go, the Brahma Jyoti, but you're just pretty much inert. So the inertia option is there for people, but to serve Krishna and to have engagements with Krishna, it simply means that the powers of the soul to act on the world and to act in the environment and to receive information and impressions from the environment. That means the soul has senses. And when we say a body, we simply mean an organized array of these senses. But a spiritual body is different from a material body. Spiritual body, first of all, it's not a machine full of pipes and pumps and tubes. It is made of concentrated Brahman. And although there are limbs or senses, every part can perform the function of all the other parts. Like a hologram. So those are the descriptions. This is a little hard for us to imagine, but then there's plenty of things that are hard for us to imagine even in this world. But that's the description from those who have been there. Okay? I think it's now time to honor prasadam. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.